morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Monday, April the 21st, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open as a subcommittee of our Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, and we will begin with a public hearing on House Bill 5013. Tap the gavel will open. And at this time, do we have a director coming back up, or are we going to begin with the public testimony?
And
Mr. Chair,
I would let him introduce.
That's what happens if you look down.
Let him introduce the people who are making the presentation.
Marty, you have to realize I was on a tractor all weekend, so there's probably dust on the glasses.
That's okay. I know that feeling only too
it's
well.
Monday.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me. What I thought we might do is, if it pleases the chairman, to look on page 34. And if you are like me, I sometimes have to go kind of back and review what happened last week. And so I thought just to take a couple of minutes and look to see where we are and maybe look to see where we might go this week. On page 34, you might see this is the business development group, if you will. And on the far right-hand bubble, you look at recruitment and marketing, and we touched base on that last week. And then retention and expansion, and we touched base on that too. The next today, we're going to be looking at small business and business finance in your bubbles there. And as you know, we've touched base a little bit on international trade on the far left-hand side. So that should complete the five different fingers, if you will, of business development, and then there will be time, obviously, to ask any questions, because some of these things that we kind of went through a little bit, but the idea was is to kind of give you an idea of business development, and again, these are the five fingers that I spoke of for our business development principles. Today, in small business and business finance, we have a distinguished gallery in back of me. Many of them will be testifying in front of you. And so what I thought I would do is just ask Ron Fox and Pat Allen to give an overview of the small business services, and then there'll be some invited testimony, and then we'll give an overview of the business finance programs, and then there will be some testimony to that too. Those are two of your bubbles on page 34. As we look forward here, I think that some of you might have gotten a little bit of a summary, but tomorrow we plan to talk about the infrastructure financing, and then the next day on community assistance, comments, and questions and answers on the 24th. On the 28th, it's proposed that we go into film and video and arts and tourism, and then any other questions too, and that should hopefully give you an idea of what we're proposing for the next couple of years in terms of the biennium. So it's a lot to hit you with on a Monday morning, but why don't we dive right into it and ask Ron Fox and Pat Allen to come on up here and see if they can give us an overview on the small business services. Ron Fox is manager of OECDD, business and industry teams, and Pat Allen is the past manager of small business services. He has since just recently relinquished that title, but his expertise and insight I thought would be very helpful as we look at this area.
Good morning, Chairman George, members of the committee. I'm just going to turn the section over to Pat, since Pat has been managing this for almost 2 years and has a great deal of familiarity with both the past results as well as the future biennial plans. So, and I'll be here to answer any questions, and I'll also be following up as we move forward from here. Pat.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I currently manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which I guess makes me the manager formerly known as the Small Business Program Manager at Economic and Community Development. What I'd like to do is just very, very quickly give you an overview of small business services at the department. Then we're going to turn it over to one of those service providers and a couple of small business owners who have used those services, and then we'll come back and give you some more context. The small business program is basically responsible for managing a portfolio of services to small businesses. The department itself does not directly provide individualized service to individual small business companies. We contract for a variety of services that touch approximately 9,000 small businesses during the current biennium. The Small Business Program also staffs the Governor's Small Business Council and does provide a degree of direct service and information referral. For 2003-05, we're projecting serving approximately creating approximately 4,180 jobs through these programs, which will be resulting from services to just under 9,000 clients, of which 45% will be either women-owned businesses or women who are entrepreneurs considering forming a business. 20% will be minority-owned businesses or minority entrepreneurs. Those services and job creation results will result in increased sales for assisted firms of about $117 million and payrolls of about $65 million. We're able to project those numbers with a pretty good degree of specificity based on a system we established this biennium for evaluating the effectiveness of our programs. We drew a pool of all of the clients assisted through June of 2002 and conducted a statistically valid random sample survey of those clients asking for their economic results after receiving services in terms of job creation, payroll, and sales, asked them to assess the relatedness of the service. In other words, you created jobs, were the services you received highly related or not related at all, and we heavily weighted it toward only those businesses that identified the services as very highly related to the services that they received. Just real briefly, that we have a lot of statutory guidance from you in terms of what we do. You'll find on page 2 of the small business portion the statutory references. Basically, you direct us to fund small business development centers, and you authorize us to have a business retention service and to contract with other service providers for small business services. And then you also provide us further guidance in terms of how we execute those contracted services and small business development center services in terms of targeting them toward women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, microenterprises, and businesses in distressed communities. The final thing before I turn it over, on page 3, you'll see kind of a graphic that we use to try to give you a rough idea of the system that's out there. These are each of the service providers with a very brief thumbnail of who their services are targeted to the clients that they serve. The circles are in rough proportion to the dollar amount that we fund. This is a $2.2 million program this biennium. You can see that sort of the keynote piece of the system is the Small Business Development Center network. The rest of the providers each provide a very specific, targeted, technical piece of small business assistance that actually works in partnership with the small business development centers to augment their reach in terms of subject matter and in terms of targeted populations. With that, what I'd like to do is leave the table and turn it over to Christine Krieger, who is the assistant state director of the Small Business Development Center Network, along with two clients of that system, to give you a bit of their perspective on how we deliver services, and then we'll come back up.
Good morning, Senator George, members of the committee. I'm Christine Krieger, for the record, the Associate State Director of the Small Business Development Center Network. I know that this committee was kind enough to hear Sandy Cutler's testimony earlier, so I won't go into anything other than to go to right to introducing you to two of our clients who have been users of our program. And I think that you'll find their stories very interesting. And I'm going to ask Carrie Wong, who is the owner of Practical Gourmet, to talk with us first.
Good morning, Chairman, Committee. I'm Carrie Wong. In January of 2002, being in international sales and marketing, my company downsized as a result of 911. At that time, I took advantage of the Small Business Development Center, all the things they offer, and developed my own business, which is a wholesale gourmet bakery and confectionery company. In the working with the center, they were very instrumental in me being able to come up with a cohesive business plan to target my market, to be able to put together a marketing plan that would be effective. And working with them through their program for 4 or 5 months, I don't recall the exact amount of time, unfortunately, the business has definitely launched. In a little over a year, I have recouped all my investment into the company. I've turned a profit. I just made an offer on a 7,000-square-foot building for expansion, and I'll be hiring 3 to 5 employees by end of summer. The business, I think, I've continued my relationship with the Small Business Development Center for a lot of their expertise and ideas and helping me go through the expansion. I've been fortunate in not needing to find funding for this company since I had my own, but I don't think my company would be where it is today without their expertise. I don't think any one small business person can have expertise in all fields. And the information and guidance they gave me was definitely key in my business becoming so successful so quickly. Thank you. Also, if I may, to show you how successful my business can be, I have brought a box of handmade gourmet chocolates that I'd like to submit to the community. Am I allowed to do that? Well, you can't judge if a company's successful unless you see what they actually do.
Okay, that's wonderful, as long as they don't look like chocolate eggs.
No, actually, there's a list inside that will tell you what they are, and this is a line of confectionery items.
We can at least look at them.
That's right.
Right. That's here alone.
Actually, Mr. Chair, that was going to be my question, was that we could relate better, I think,
With the quality.
To quality, yes. And if we'd actually seen a sample. Mm-hmm. So I compliment you for the totalness of your presentation.
And you don't judge a wine by looking at the bottle, right?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Morris.
You can't look at these.
Oh, no.
I looked at them and I was sorry because I wanted them.
Oh, my.
I'm not going to. She's not going to look. She's not going to. Are there any questions, Carrie, other than the quality of the product?
Looks incredible.
The only question is, do you use hazelnuts in any of this?
Mr. Chairman, you'll find a list of products there that one of them is specifically an Oregon hazelnut bar made with strictly Oregon hazelnuts. I do use Oregon products first and always, subject to availability for my needs. And that is something that I have premised the company on.
Very, very good. Any further questions? Thanks, Carrie.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's now a pleasure to introduce to you Mark Flaming, who is the president or the owner of Lava Gear Clothing from Hood River.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Mark Flaming. I'm the owner of Lava Gear. It's an outdoor clothing company. July of last year, we started the company in Costa Rica in Central America, and maybe one of the few companies who moved from overseas to the United States. We chose, we moved our headquarters to the United States and chose Oregon in particular because two reasons. One is that it has a very strong business cluster in the outdoor clothing company, particularly in Portland. The other is that Oregon has the kind of outdoor lifestyle that's very important to the outdoor industry if you're manufacturing. Arrived in Hood River in July of last year and made contact immediately with Columbia Gorge Community College and the Small Business Support Program there. And I think I'd like to relate three ways in which they've been extremely helpful. One is that as a company moving, particularly coming from overseas, moving into the area, the counselor in the program played a primary role in making introductions to the, first of all, the Chamber of Commerce, other members of the business community, the local banks, and then giving me a quick overview of what kinds of business support programs, financial and otherwise, there were in the area. That was instrumental because the transition can be a difficult time, and I owe a lot to the counselor in particular for making those introductions. The second is just basic business support. The particular counselor who works out of the Dalles the Columbia Gorge Community College is particularly good, and as a counselor and mentor has been a good person to use as a backboard, sounding board in developing business plans. Third, and I think probably most importantly, is that as the business has grown and we've required financing, First of all, the introductions that the counselor made and then my participating in the program was very helpful in developing a financing package, which in the end a local community bank submitted to MCED, Mid-Columbia Economic Development District. It was a financing package in which the local community bank basically matched or proposed to match funding coming from MCED and it was approved. I think that, you know, the in that instance in particular, the small business support services helped not only me but the local bank, so that when I made my proposal as a business, by that I had already been there for a while, I had known members of the community, I had shared my ideas with other business members, the Chamber of Commerce, and the actual financing package itself, I got significant support from the counselor in putting that together. Right now, the company's in the second year. We employ 4 people full-time in Hood River, 1 person part-time, and we contract a lot of services and are converting those positions into full-time employment as we grow. We're extremely happy about being in Hood River and in Oregon in general, and have found the business support services that we have received through the program to be extremely useful, and would rate them highly among the resources that a business moving to the area can avail themselves of. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Well, we thank you for bringing business to Oregon.
Pleasure.
Senator George, members of the committee, thank you very much. Turn it back to Pat and Ron.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, just a few other brief points. I actually misspoke slightly a bit ago. I mentioned a $2.2 million program. That's the Small Business Development Center funding amount that we provide in the current biennium. Our small business program in total, this biennium in terms of community development fund, is $3.4 million. We propose in the 03-05 budget to reduce that to $3.1 million. That would be funding the SBDCs at $2.2 million and the other contracted services at $900,000. Both of those dollar amounts actually remain the same in that budget. Just a word about how we go about contracting for these services. We significantly revamped the system of contracting with small business development centers this biennium to try to improve performance and accountability. Previously, we entered into 19 separate contracts with each of the individual centers at each individual college. We had a performance plan that was based on statewide totals, and one of the results we had with a system like that is we effectively had circumstances where you could have good performance in some areas, sort of masked underperformance in other areas, and we really tried to break that out. We entered into this biennium a single contract with Lane Community College to administer the overall system. We then identified performance benchmarks in each of 36 counties in terms of numbers of clients, numbers of women and minority-owned business clients, and percentages of clients that were in distressed communities. And we effectively contracted with the network to deliver us each of those kinds of numbers in each county, irrespective of which college they were going to use to do that. That helped us, in fact, re-engineer the system in Eastern Oregon by reconfiguring the geography and moving some account responsibilities around to some centers and more effectively using our resources. And it also helped us make sure that we were adequately focusing on those targeted populations that statute calls for. In addition to the small business development centers, then, we issued a request for proposals at the beginning of the biennium for the $900,000 worth of contracted services. We received about 16 different proposals of different kinds of targeted services at women and minority-owned businesses primarily, although not exclusively, and then we picked the best 8 of those and entered into contracts over the biennium. In terms of results, if you look on page 6, you'll see a table that provides the results broken out by small business development centers and then the other 8 providers all lumped together. These are the results that are drawn from the survey that I mentioned earlier. And it gives you a pretty good picture in terms of numbers of clients served, nearly 11,000, over 5,000 jobs created, and significant amounts of new payroll and sales increase. And again, these are all results that the businesses attributed as being highly related to the services that they received. And these are businesses that they don't get any benefit from telling us one answer or another. There's nothing, it's not like a situation where we've provided them a loan that turns into a grant or something. If they achieve enough jobs, they have no conflicted motivation to give us anything other than accurate figures. And then at the bottom of the chart, you'll see the breakout of client demographics.
We're essentially, under your statutory guidance, pushing the system to help generate more women and minority-owned businesses. And, in fact, Oregon is one of, if not the top state in the nation for percentage of businesses owned by women at something about 33% of businesses. We're working hard to do better in the minority-owned business area, and we're delivering. 18% of our clients are minority-owned businesses or minority entrepreneurs. That's not much above the rate of minorities in the population, but it's significantly above the rate of minority business ownership, which is about 7%. Finally, on page 7, I know one of the things you often hear in this kind of a discussion is, well, these organizations are just dealing with, you know, mom-and-pop businesses and coffee carts and those kinds of things. I'd like you to take a look at the pie chart that shows the categorization of businesses served by small business development centers, which is the lion's share of our clients, and 17% of those businesses are manufacturers, which mirrors the percentage of manufacturing. And actually, in fact, it's a tad higher than the percentage of manufacturing in the economy overall. And then the last thing, just to bring your attention to, because you may have already noticed it, the numbers of clients served are in fact decreasing. We expect to serve somewhere on the order of about 11,000 businesses this biennium. That's down from a high probably two biennia ago of about 14,000 businesses. We project only 9,000 businesses this next biennium. And what's really driving that are changes in the community college system's funding of the Small Business Development Center network. We project at this stage something on the order of a cumulative cut of about 40 or 45% in the college funding of centers. The system is approximately half funded by the colleges today, and so we would be effectively reducing that to something like 25% funding, and inescapably the impact of that is to drive down the reach of the centers and the number of clients that can be served. With that, I think that's all the overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, can I might turn back to, I guess it's page 6, the bar chart. There's some factors at the top of the page on that with respect to 0102 result, job, wages, and sales. What are those factors that you're building in there?
Chair George, Senator Morse, what we did is we hired an independent contractor outside the agency to whom all of our service providers submitted their complete client lists. That contractor then drew from those lists a statistically valid random sample of businesses. It was about 700 businesses altogether out of the 11,000 or so served. And then did basically about a 15-minute phone survey with those businesses and asked them questions like, since receiving services, did your employment change? Did your payroll change? Did your sales change? And then once getting those kinds of answers, asked on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being not at all and 5 being completely, how related was the service you received to the results that you've reported? We counted only the 4s and 5s. A more liberal way of going about that might have said, well, you count a little bit of the 1s and a little more of the 2s and a little more of the 3s. We didn't do that. We totally took those off the table. We also assumed if they made a phone call and it was a disconnected phone number, we assumed that all of those numbers and, of course, all of the more that they represent in the pool were out of business, when, in fact, probably if you'd have done some digging, you could have found that they were somewhere else and had a new phone number or something like that. So we tried to ratchet the number down that way and tried at each step where there was a judgment call like that to make very conservative assumptions about the pool. We then took those response rates and projected them onto the overall population to get the resulting job creation, wages, and estimated sales. Oh, you're talking about the on the right-hand side?
Correct.
I apologize. It's been a little while since I've looked at these numbers, and I'm having to look at them. I believe that is. Senator, I'd have to go back and look and see where those factors drew from. I'm sure that it's the calculation that I referred to that gets us to those numbers, but I can't track off the top of my head how it breaks into those particular notations.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair George. I remind the committee And for the record, I have a direct conflict of interest as I am a contract director for the Small Business Development Center at Eastern Oregon University. With that said, I have a question. We talked about the impact of potential reduced funding to the community colleges. What's the strategy to deal with those community colleges that don't have the ability to step up and provide the necessary funding? How are we going to ensure that the communities and the small businesses get the assistance that they need?
Chair George, Representative Smith, I'll take an initial stab at this in terms of where the strategy was when I left, and then Ron and Marty may want to step in and talk about how it's evolved since then. There is a piece of the department's omnibus bill that asks for authorization to contract with others than colleges for delivery of Small Business Development Center services. Right now, that's a statutory exclusive. And so we're trying to give ourselves a little bit of legal running room to be able to construct a system on the ground in various parts of the state that matches who's available to actually deliver service. As Representative Smith alludes to, we're in a situation now where if budget cuts happen at the college level the way we expect they might, we might actually lose potentially a significant number of colleges as participants in the system. We certainly don't want that. We think colleges are a good partner and are a way that makes sense to deliver this service, but we're trying to be flexible enough to maintain some kind of on-the-ground presence around the state and to try to continue to provide 36 counties worth of coverage. At the end of the day, the reality is if the budget cuts at the college level particularly are significant enough, we may lose our ability to provide that 36-county coverage in any kind of a meaningful way and certainly in a face-to-face way. Ron or Marty might want to add to that.
Chairman George, members of the committee, I think Pat has summarized it fairly closely. I just want to go back. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Ron Fox, I'm manager of business and industry team at the Department of Economic Community Development. Pat did a good job of summarizing it. When he spoke earlier about the funding components that support the small business development centers, we talked about, I think, about the community college participation, but the federal government, Small Business Administration, is also a funder of those programs. And so we've had meetings with the Community College Network and with the Small Business Program from the federal to try to find ways to do as Pat said, try to make sure that we can provide a level of service throughout all of Oregon that is that meets those needs and serves the small businesses. But the financial challenges, particularly the funding that has historically come from the community colleges, and there are, I think, actually three universities that actually provide the support, is a difficult challenge for us. It's we're really stretching to try to maintain the level of output that has happened, and I would say has been an exemplary program across the country for small business services. So it's going to be a very difficult biennium.
Thank you. Not knowing the appropriateness of conflict of interest issues, I think I at least need to share with the committee that I personally have been the recipient of small business community small business development center services, in that an inventor came to me with an idea. I knew nothing about metallurgy, and I gave him the outline of a business plan, and I said, would you elaborate and show cause as to why this should be a good investment? He went to the Lynn Benton Community College Small Business Development Center. They helped him put that together, and the upshot of that is a company that's thriving, 14 family wage jobs in Sweet Home, which is a depressed area. And so I would just state by disclosure that I've been a recipient, but also an affirmation of the importance of this service, because had that not happened, this company would never have been formed.
Is that where you use the word upshot?
It's heavy shot.
Senator George, if I could come back to Senator Morse's question. I stared at those numbers long enough to, I believe, remember what they mean. 18.9% of Small Business Development Center clients and 30% of the other clients report having created jobs. Those that reported creating jobs created 2.4 jobs per company and 2.2 jobs per company, respectively, across those two populations. And so you multiply those two factors against the total number of clients to get the job creation figures.
And the other numbers are just average, the reported average numbers.
Correct.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair. As you're dealing with ongoing change of the program, especially with budgetary constraints, I know you folks have an advisory committee. Can you talk a little bit about who's on the advisory committee and what role they play in helping to guide the SBDC?
Yes, Chairman George, Representative Smith, the advisory committee I believe you're referring to is the Governor's Small Business Council, and they are appointed by the governor and represent small business owners and small business service providers from across the state. They provide us with a sounding board as to issues that are significant in impact and significant in importance and success for small businesses across the state. I would say their focus is broader than just our contract services in the form of small business development centers and the minority and women-owned contractors. But they do cover those areas or address those areas in conjunction with us. I should say that Eric Blackledge, who is a member of the Governor's Small Business Council, former chair of the Governor's Small Business Council, is in the audience today, and I would be more than happy to ask Eric to come up because he can speak directly from the council's activity, if that would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair, if I could just expand briefly also on Ron's answer. There is a second advisory body that is the Small Business Development Center Network's Advisory Committee. That's a statewide, federally mandated advisory committee made up of a number of college presidents, representatives of the state, and the U.S. Small Business Administration, which is the other funding partner for the system, as well as a number of business owners who also have an advisory role in terms of how the services are delivered and the system is executed.
Representative Smith, that was exactly what I was going to say, is that is a much more specific advisory body to the SBDCs.
Could we get your name?
Eric Blackledge, Vice Chair of the Governor's Small Business Council.
Step in just a little bit and kind of take a little bit different view of this. Small businesses, as we all know, is an extremely important part of the infrastructure, the economic infrastructure of the state. We sometimes struggle to figure out what our role is with the small businesses because many of those small businesses are, quite frankly, undefined as to what small business is. Second of all, many of those small businesses are struggling just to keep their head above water. And so this program is a modest program, as you can tell from the expenditure, but nevertheless an important one, too. We also try to find out the accountability side. That was one of the things that I really kind of wanted to zero right in on and say, how do we know how many jobs are being created in a small business when small businesses, by definition, sometimes are opening and closing or changing around an awful lot? So what we've tried to do and will continue to do is increase our efforts in terms of that accountability to really kind of zero right in and say, are we getting the bang for the buck? That's really what we're going to be focusing on in the next couple of years. If you assume that the figures of 5,000 jobs are somewhat in the ball game, well then I will tell you that we would do flip-flops to get 5,000 jobs right now, and are doing flip-flops in order to get 5,000 jobs. So for the amount of money proposed and the return of approximately 5,000 jobs, I think that we feel comfortable that we're on track here in a difficult environment of small business development.
No. All right. Let's go ahead and proceed.
On page 34 of your booklet, too, Mr. Chair, there is that what I call the fifth finger, if you will, of the of our business plan, and that is the business finance programs. Again, as you break down the business finance programs, the ability to finance certain companies at different stages of their maturity is an important aspect, we think, of our economic development program or view. This is headed up by Mark Houston. He is manager of business finance, and he will describe to you again there are five basic business finance programs that we try to help different businesses throughout the state in different ways. So I'd like to introduce Mark at this time.
Thank you. Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As Mr. Brantley indicated, my name is Mark Houston. I manage business finance for the department. And I have two guests here today to talk about their specific experiences with the business finance programs, Pete Martini with American Laminators from Drain, and Jeff Workala from Hardwood Industries. Overall, our responsibilities are to increase access to capital to encourage job-creating investment in Oregon. To do this, we operate two bank guarantee programs. One is called the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund, and the other is called the Oregon Capital Access Program. We offer two direct loan programs, one, the Oregon Business Development Fund, and the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. We also administer the Oregon Industrial Development Bond Program and the Strategic Investment Program that I think you heard about earlier this or last week. Our goals are to increase the number and depth of relationships with banks, and we currently have 40 banks that are enrolled in our guarantee programs. And that we consider that an excellent base that is growing. We also want to increase the number and depth of relationships with local development groups, small business development centers, and other delivery partners. We want to increase the visibility of business finance programs to Oregon businesses and enhance existing programs to better serve Oregon businesses with appropriate level of fiscal responsibility. For the next biennium, our targets are to finance or to help finance through these programs 330 projects, the bulk of which will be leveraged through bank lending with guarantees or providing subordinate financing. We anticipate facilitating $115 million in new investment in Oregon and to help Oregon businesses create or retain 2,400 jobs, and that does not include the Strategic Investment Program. Our target is really to existing growing companies in Oregon, and the bulk are manufacturers. On the question of why do we do this work, ORS directs the Revised Ed Directs Department, among other things, to do the following, and these are excerpted from statute: to maintain and create jobs that raise real wage levels of Oregon workers, improve the competitiveness of this state's traded sector industries, invest public money in a manner that produces the greatest possible return on investment, encourage the expansion of existing Oregon businesses and attraction of new business and industry to the communities that desire such development, and assist in the development of microenterprise enterprises in Oregon. And then there's the statutory sites for those. Overseeing this effort is the Finance Committee for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. They oversee the bond and loan activity for business finance, and this, it has the site for the committee statutory authorization. Bill Humphreys is the chair of the committee. He's the president and CEO of Citizens Bank in Corvallis. There are two other bankers that sit on this committee, Rhonda Wills from Astoria and Jim McCall from the Dalles, and two business people, Dave Gilbert from Roseburg and Bill Copenhaver from Salem. How do we carry out this work? There's a flowchart on in your booklets on the business finance program delivery. We deliver programs through a variety of partners. Banks and bank loan officers are our key partner for origination and delivery of business finance products. We work closely with local development groups, small business development centers, underwriters, and other business professional leverage staff and program resources. Our programs help business partners complete financing packages that by providing risk mitigation, completing a financial package when private financing is maximized, and providing an incentive to undertake a project in Oregon. We have six and a third people to complete this work. The manager, which is I'm the manager of the business finance group. Four business finance officers that do the bulk of the work in delivering the bond and loan and loan guarantee programs to clients and doing the financial analysis and recommendations. One administrative assistant and a third of an accountant's time. The budget is $1.6 million for program services, the administrative part, and $17.8 million of the Community Development Fund. And this is expenditure authority. There's no new money in that budget. This is either guarantee authority or revolving amounts that come through the revolving loan funds. I mentioned the 0305 projected results, 2,400 projected jobs created or saved, financing 330 companies and $115 million in new investment. Our experience from 1997, and there's the detail of, and I won't go through that, the detail of each one of the programs rolls up into that total. And in 1997 through 03 results had 6,000 projected jobs created or saved. We financed 1,374 companies and $377 million in new investment. For 99-02, there was 23% of the loans went to women and minority companies, owned companies, and 72% at the beginning of 99, up to 90% of loans are made in rural or distressed areas of the state. And then I'm going to flip over the detail on the 97 through 03 and go to the cost per job. We do a cost per job analysis. Business finance programs earn income through fees and interest that we charge for the program. The legislature over time has invested approximately $20 million into the business finance group, and it's now valued at nearly $30 million. We earn approximately a 4% return, financial return on investment. As a result, the actual job cost is zero to the state because we do earn income. Over time, these programs have earned a net profit of approximately $7.65 million. Ignoring the earnings of the programs, the cost per job is estimated at $386 for administration and $400 in loan losses per job. And then I always get the question of what's the loan losses for the program. On average, business finance programs have a loan loss of approximately 5.26%. And again, these losses are offset by income earned in the programs. And a recent comparison of the Oregon Business Development Fund to other revolving loan funds across the nation showed the Oregon Business Development Fund losses are less than the national average. Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I believe it was, and they were looking at a little bit different number than the loan losses, but it was about one percentage point higher on a national average basis than what we're experiencing.
We began this program back in, well, we start setting marks that we wanted to benchmarks in the state back in 1987. The capital access piece in particular, as well as the business development loan program, the program that we designed in this state to help small businesses. And we've always, Oregon has always set the precedence for being less, for losing less than national, other states across the nation has done. And I'm really glad to hear that we still have that kind of landmark in the state to be able to do that. But one of my questions would be in terms of this is that how can we identify the numbers of jobs, the fastest growing businesses, number one, and number two, the numbers of jobs that we are creating as a result of them. As you know, this has been kind of my baby, the small business piece, since I've been in the legislature. And so I really do want to see us continue to support, Mr. Chairman, support the small business development piece here because it's so needed, and it is the stabilizing force in our state. And even though a lot of people dinged Oregon for being able to support small businesses in this way because they say government does not drive, well, government support
And I think it's important for small businesses and the work that they're doing here to do that. But I think having a record of the numbers of jobs that have been created as a result of that is something in terms of accountability that we would need to have, and I think that would.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, and we did a survey a couple of years ago on the impact of small business of the business finance programs, and surveyed the customers of the business finance programs, and would be happy to make this available to the committee. The results were very positive out of the survey. The jobs that the companies were projecting at that time were being created by a multiple of 1.6 to what they had projected. And again, as a group, so there were some that didn't do as well, and others that did better. And these were self-reported numbers from the companies that were surveyed. But overall, a very positive report, and be happy to make that report available to the committee. And just one other point too, we do target our programs, as I mentioned, mostly to manufacturers, processors, some high technology businesses across the state. And really, once we've established that broad parameter, then projects come to us that are companies that are looking at, and generally through banks that are looking to expand their operations. And so we're really responsive to the market, if you will, in looking at really a wide variety of different types of companies that are looking to expand from across the state.
Senator Morris,
thank you. If you could help me understand the kind of the cycling of the cash, you got approximately $17.8 million in the community development fund. Is that a net expense, or is that offset by loan repayments? If you could maybe elaborate a little bit on just how these dollars flow and what truly is a net expense in this budget, and where that repayment then shows up.
At the bottom of page 4?
At the bottom of page 4, yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, and that number isn't, even though it's called an expenditure authority, it's really probably more, should be more characterized as an investment authority. This would be, and $15 million of that is the revolving amount of loans that we would make out of what's called the Oregon Business Development Fund. So this would be a cap, if you will, or a limit that's put on as far as the revolving amount. So this would be money that's coming back into the fund, made from repayments from companies that we have previously financed, that then is revolved back out to other companies in investment amounts. So those, and then there's $2 million that is for an amount that we could pay on claims made in our guarantee programs, that amount is and again would be a limit, if you will, and if there were more claims than that, then I'm sure we would be back to you or to the emergency board to get an expenditure authority. But that would be a maximum of what we anticipate our amount would be out in paying for loan losses as a result of guarantees that occur. And then the other $820,000 is again a revolving amount for the microloan program. And again, that would be monies that have been repaid and then recycled out to other businesses. And as I mentioned, that's not, none of this is new money that is included within the Community Development Fund. And the program services amount is also paid for by interest earnings on, and fees on the funds.
Thank you. Mr. Mason. Oh, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, the 5-point something loan loss, that's based on the history of the program. In this economic climate, are you seeing any indication that you've got more underperforming or non-performing loans? Are there any warning signs in terms of the loan guarantees or the rates that we should be aware of or worried about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, it's something we worry about all the time. But actually, our experience has been we haven't seen that specifically in loan losses where companies have either filed for bankruptcy. We haven't seen an uptick in that. We have seen, and frankly, we're talking to a lot of companies where they are struggling through this tough time in the recession. They're, you know, they have a difficult time, you know, making payments, obviously, and but we haven't seen our default rates increase. But we do work with companies that are, you know, having some difficulty, and we do have, you know, the capability of being able to help them weather some of these tough times with you know, within limits of financial prudence.
Do we participate with the bank in making the decision when to pull the plug on a business that may be in trouble?
Mr. Chairman, we do. In the guarantee programs, and there's two guarantee programs. One guarantee program, and we really do take the bank's lead. The state does have the capability of being able to step in, if you will, to the shoes of the bank and, you know, take over a troubled scenario. That hasn't happened to date in our guarantee programs. But we do work very closely with the bank, and in the guarantee programs, they filed their own documents, the bank's documents, and so they're doing their best efforts to collect. And in every one of these cases, the bank is at risk on their own money, so for a portion of the project, and so they have an interest too in making the best of the scenario, whether or not that's continuing the business or, you know, liquidating the assets and maximizing their return that they can. Okay. And on the direct loan programs, we do have a separate loan that's made, and so we make our own decisions based on that scenario. But often there's a bank involved, and we'll be talking to the bank about their, you know, their strategies also.
This is new to me, so help me when I understand this. If we have a loan guarantee, and you said the bank has some sort of liability, my assumption was that the bank, if it had to liquidate, would liquidate all the assets and then contact us for the balance. But apparently it doesn't work that way if they have any liability.
Mr. Chairman, the way it works is that the bank would, you know, in that scenario, would move to liquidate. There would be a deficiency at the end of the day, if there is a deficiency after the collateral is liquidated, and then we guarantee a portion of that, and it can be up to 90%, but in many cases it's, you know, 50%. So the bank would take 50% of the loss, and we would take 50% or more. If it was a 90% guarantee, we would take 90%, and the bank would take 10%.
But those numbers are determined up front?
Those numbers are determined up front. We make an authorization, and we provide a guarantee based on, you know, a maximum amount of guarantee and a maximum amount of, and then we set what our guarantee percentage is. Correct.
Mr. Chair, if I may, coming into the job, one of my questions was, first of all, why do we do this? And that's one of the reasons that we have this question here. And as you can kind of understand, this is a great deal of support to certain businesses that might not get loans right off the top. In other words, why do they need a credit guarantee? Well, they need a credit guarantee for a variety of reasons, but sometimes it's that they just can't walk into the bank and don't have a balance sheet that is strong enough in order to get the loans in the first place. So the second question that I had is this an appropriate role for us to play? And particularly when I saw the success of it, quite frankly, I thought, well, yes, we are making money. It's not a large amount of money. So somewhere in between is the right appropriate stance, I thought. And so I became comfortable with what we're doing. As long as we're making a modest amount of money off of keeping companies going, growing, if you will, particularly the manufacturing sector, which is an important sector, I thought that probably was an important role too. My third question is then, why can't the banks do that themselves? And again, I probably answered that a little bit first off, is the banks probably don't want to do this or don't want that exposure totally. And that's where we step in on the guarantee side of it, or in certain cases actually do the loans themselves. It is a risky area, if you will. Our loan losses are a little bit higher than, they are lower than the national average, but they're higher than a traditional bank. That's to be expected, quite frankly. But overall, we're still making money on it. And so my sense was that that was the appropriate middle ground that we were marching, and so I got comfortable that way.
Representative Smith.
Chair George, you started to address the issue I have a question about. On your loan losses of 5.26%, is that after liquidation of any loan loss reserves?
Let me I can answer that, and if you want, if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that number is actually the money that we put, or an amount that we would set aside, if you will, into the loan loss reserve account. So that is not our actual losses. Our losses are less than that amount. But that would be what we project, you know, over time, would be the losses that we would see on these accounts. And so if that answers your question.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Is it possible to get a percentage of those loans that go into a default by the total number of loans? So if you had 100 loans and 7 went into default, what's the percentage of bad loans?
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, and I can get the exact numbers for you, but the numbers and the amounts track very closely. So it would be both the number and dollar amount would be approximately the same.
Thank you, Chair Carter. And then based on that, what I'd be interested in knowing is what is the state's exposure in terms of those delinquent loans? I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how are we collateralized on those credits? Because I'm under the assumption that if a loan goes into default, we have adequate collateral to get ourselves out of the deal.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, in all of the programs, we have adequate collateral going into the project, and as probably every lender would tell you, they're intending to make a good loan and have adequate collateral as a part of that transaction. We do provide guarantees and subordinate financing on riskier projects, and as a part of that, we do see scenarios where the collateral doesn't and the guarantees, and we have personal guarantees on virtually all of the projects that we work on, don't get the full return to the state, but that's our intention, and that's how we write the projects.
Thank you, Chair Carter. If we're not able to recover 100%, can you spend a little bit of time talking about how a typical workout situation would work? I guess I'm of the opinion, because I manage loan programs in my company, that, an ounce of prevention saves about 40 pounds of cure when it comes to dealing with a credit. So I guess I'd be interested in knowing how the state deals with those situations and when.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Carter, Representative Smith, let me start with the scenario that we do try to do the ounce of prevention, if you will, or even the pound of prevention in difficult scenarios, and we do have the capability of working with companies and working through scenarios that are challenging for the company. If things do turn poorly, and as I mentioned, we do have personal guarantees in virtually all of these scenarios, our preference would be initially for the company directly to liquidate any collateral and maximize a return. They're the ones that are in the business, in the industry, and can look to the collateral to maximize their return. In the event that that doesn't work, we have, and it's not that often, to be honest with you, where we do have to go in to claim the collateral and sell it. It is a pretty rare instance where we're in that specific scenario. But we do have, and working with the Attorney General's office, I think have developed over time very good working legal documents that protect the state, and we will claim that collateral and sell it at the highest amount possible to return to the state.
I apologize. I just really want to understand how this all works. Couple questions all wrapped into one. Does the state, as part of its program, require annual financial statements? And do we have a tracking system in place to ensure that everything from property tax and personal taxes are current to ensuring that the collateral positions we thought we had, we know we have 5 years from now into a loan?
Senator Carter, Representative Smith, we do have systems in place for getting financial statements and updates on insurance, those kind of things as far as the servicing is required. For our guarantee programs, that goes back to the bank, and that is a very good process for the bank doing their work in making sure that they have the servicing work in place and that gets accomplished on a reasonable time frame. The servicing for UCC filings, as you probably know, are filed and did have a five-year life that needed to be re-upped, but that's been modified through the Secretary of State's office, so we have some improvements from that perspective. But overall, I think our servicing is a good system. Always can use some improvement, but that's part of our objective is to always improve our processing.
Senator Carter.
Representative Smith, the state made this a policy decision years ago simply because most of the small businesses that were starting up in this company were not fly-by-night people. They were not, we were basically looking at distressed communities like North Northeast Portland and looking at places as far away as Coos Bay, where we had lost so many board feet of lumber and businesses had gone down. And so we were looking at distressed communities like that. And at that time, banks were not loaning, and we were seeing a lot of redlining to my friends in the banking community that was going on. And businesses that want to start up, especially when you look at emerging small businesses, there was no possibility of equity that they had because they were starting from little garages and this kind of stuff. And so if you look at this from a statistical point of view, yes, your line of questioning is going to be exactly what it is, and we should be accountable in that particular kind of way. But if you look at it in terms of how these businesses start and how they grow, I bet that you're probably going to see, three out of 100 businesses that are failing in small businesses. But the policy is that it was a greater risk, at the same time a greater accountability, for us as a state to help these small businesses than for the bank, because we had a chance to talk with the FDIC, and FDIC was saying, well, we don't want that kind of exposure because look how it would look on our pages as a national financial institution. So I personally think, even until this day, if there's going to be risk in growing opportunity in our state, then the state must take it. I mean, the state should take it through these kind of opportunities, because all of these small business people that get started are basically taxpayers like you and me, and that helping small businesses in this way, to me, is a very small peanut in the scheme of nuts, if you were to think of it that particular kind of way. And so I think the policy decision that was made, that we made that many years ago, has boded us well in terms of how you see small businesses growing in this state.
Chair George, I think you won't find a stronger advocate of these programs than myself.
I hear you.
The reason I'm asking the questions I'm asking is, for every dollar that we ensure we return back into the revolving loan fund, is another dollar we can put out into the communities. And I've seen loan programs that have been very successful with zero loan losses. I know one personally. And I also know loan programs that run 7, 8, 9, 10%. And so I'm just very concerned that we make sure the money is well managed so we can get it back out. I think he does a fabulous job. So.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. On page 5, 6, 7, you've got projected created 12 times. How do you project? How do you know? How do you verify? At what point do you ever get a firm number? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, the numbers that are projected, and we when an application comes in from a business, they project what they think the employment will result as a result of the project that they're undertaking. And you'll be able to talk to a couple of companies here about that, you know, that process if you would like. Obviously, they're optimistic. They're looking to be successful in their project. We do look at it from a staff standpoint of saying, is it reasonable? You know, are they adding 20,000 square feet, and then is it 20 jobs, and does that make sense from a general perspective? Then once the project is completed, we do surveys of companies, and we've spent actually a considerable amount of time in that arena. And the survey that I mentioned earlier that I'll make happy to make available to the committee goes back out to the companies and asks them the question: how many jobs were created as a result of the project? And how important was the financing to you? What would have you done without the financing? And those results are incorporated within that survey. We also have spent considerable time updating that information and trying to make that current for you. So. Happy to provide this information to you and answer any additional questions that you might have.
Follow up. Same if you can't. A projected job and actually a job created is two different things. And you may do a survey, but then you go down, if you go to the cost per job estimate is also estimated. So everything's in flux. You don't really know. The job might be costing you $800. 900, you don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Krieger, and the cost per job is information from the survey results. So those would be the actual reported jobs that the companies report. We have spent time, get additional information on that. Obviously, the companies are reporting that information, and it's their best estimate of the impact of the project, and that's information that we get reported back. So that cost per job was based on the actual reported information.
Follow up. Projected jobs created. Why don't we have a number on every one of these actual jobs created, known, verified?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Krieger, and for the information that is provided as a result of the past information, we could probably estimate that for you, or get that information for you specifically on companies. When we do surveys, often we're looking at different blocks of time, so it doesn't match at 100%. And this survey result, did take information from a specific block of time and was a prepared survey that did get us that information. For projected information, we won't know that information, obviously, until 2 years maybe down the line. Generally, we give the companies about 2 years to perform or to see how well the jobs have materialized.
Representative Smith.
I have two questions, but I want to finish kind of what we're talking about. I would imagine it's very difficult to get exact job creation numbers after you close a loan. Because once the funds are dispersed and payments are being made and the company has moved on, this reporting back on job creation numbers really isn't the highest priority. And the state's been in an awkward situation of what do you do when you've got a loan that's paying as agreed, is doing gangbusters in the community, but no longer sees it as a priority to fill out a little survey. Anyway, that's an observation. I've got to ask two.
Just while you're on, the, Mr. Chairman, and I think that's good, that's a very good observation. But we did when the survey did go out, we did get, I think, very good response rates for the Oregon Business Development Fund, 62% response rate, the Credit Enhancement Fund, 57%, the Industrial Development Bond Program, 72%, the Entrepreneurial Loan Program, 52%, and then the Capital Access Program, which is a smaller guarantee program, only 25%. But that I think overall we're getting a pretty good response rate from companies based on a survey, because, you know, no one likes to fill out surveys.
I stand corrected. that's fabulous. Okay, I've got to ask two real tough questions. On the business finance program as a whole, can I get information on the application turnaround time from the time you receive an application to the time the funds are dispersed on each of the programs? And I know there's varying factors in all those, but I'd be interested in that. And then the second question, if I could get information on, each loan officer originates 3.1 projects on average per month and has 100 projects. Can I get information on the dollar value of their portfolios and what they're managing in terms of having to service portfolios?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Smith, and I'd be happy to get you that information. And if I can speak generally to turnaround times, for our guarantee programs, one guarantee program is really within days of receiving an application. We don't... We view those more from an eligibility perspective than an underwriting perspective. And the other guarantee program, we advertise that we will have a 2-week turnaround, and we achieve that virtually across the board for approvals on the guarantee programs. And our direct loan programs are more in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 weeks for our application turnaround. So I think we try to move pretty aggressively to turn around projects, but I'll get you the specific information.
That meets my needs. Thank you. That's really good.
Point of curiosity, we probably in the last 10 years, I think the profitability of average farm other than a nursery has been very, very poor. Probably 8 out of the 10 you broke even or lost money. But a lot of us are surviving because we're doing value add. Do we have loans available, you know, for the person who's saying, well, I'm going to do additional processing, I'm going to do the roadside stand type of thing, which has been amazingly successful, and by the way, plays in well with stuff like tourism. People like to see that kind of stuff.
Senator George, we do value-added processing in the agriculture industry all the time. That is one of our strike zones, if you will, in the agriculture community in particular. We don't do a lot of direct farm loans in particular. On roadside stands, that, you know, sort of moves over into the retail arena, but we do have a couple of programs, in particular one guarantee program that could work for a roadside stand kind of operation.
It's not a problem, you know, like, for example, when we begin to run, we'll have up to 30 employees, but it may be for 3 months. But it works good for the community because we have people that are coming off construction jobs in the bad part of the winter, who come right in and really appreciate the fact that we're there to give them a good job with reasonable wages. So is that a problem for the fact that there isn't year-round employment as far as your rating of that?
Senator George, no, it's not. And actually we have in the past and can do set amortization schedules, for example, that would allow the seasonality factor. And again, if it's reasonable to make double payments during the summer, for example, and it doesn't happen very often,
right.
But we work with that kind of seasonal business all the time.
Okay, so the seasonality wouldn't be a problem as far as the possibility of a loan.
No. And actually, and it could be, you know, from a bank standpoint, that could be a risk parameter where they may want a state guarantee where that, you know, that bumps up the risk a little bit because of the seasonality factor, and that could be one of the reasons that they would come to us.
But I thought you didn't have anything for retail and service industry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, actually we have two programs, one guarantee program that called the Capital Access Program that can work with any type of business anywhere in the state other than residential housing and refinancing. That's been a very active program for us. The other guarantee program called the Credit Enhancement Fund, we can do retail businesses in distressed areas of the state. So that was expanded by the legislature two legislatures ago, I believe, that expanded that program so we can do guarantees for all types of businesses in distressed areas with that program. So we do, and in our microloan program, we work with all types of businesses also. So we do have some capability, and I shouldn't just say some. It's a pretty good capability of working with retail and service businesses. If I could, Mr. Chair, and actually, one of the things I wanted to mention was for our direct loan programs, we do even in our direct loan programs, we participate with a bank generally, except for the microloan program. And we have two guests here that can describe for you their experience, in particular with the Oregon Business Development Fund, where they received a state loan, but also was financed in part, in most part, by a bank. And it's Pete Martini from American Laminators and Jeff Workla from Hardwood Industries. So if it would be appropriate, we could bring them up now.
That would be great.
Good morning, I'm Pete Martini with American Laminators, and I've been with American Laminators about 25 years. American Laminators is headquartered in Drain, Oregon. That particular facility there was incorporated in 1962, so it's been a member of the community for more than 40 years. And from there, we branched off and built another company in Swiss Home, Oregon, which is over by Mapleton, not to be confused with Sweet Home. We manufacture glue laminated beams where we take lumber from 2x4 size through 2x12 and we finger join it to specific lengths and then lay it up into specific beams. And each lamination is graded and it's all engineered. We went through the usual wood product cycles in our industry, and in 1988 was our peak year with sales of $30 million. And within 3 years, we were at sales of $12 million, which was quite a hit to the company, but we survived it. After that time, we just kind of struggled along, some years profitable, some years break-even. And the investors in the company wanted out. They were well into their 70s. And so we put the company up for sale for about 3 years, could not find any interested buyers. All the venture capitalists were interested in dot-com companies and not interested in any struggling company in the wood products business. The owners said, we need to liquidate the company. We're too old. We don't want to be in it anymore. And we did then were contacted by the, or we contacted the Oregon Business Development, and they really saved our bacon. Pacific Continental Bank was interested in funding a portion of it, but our needs to buy out the existing shareholders exceeded what they were willing to do by the parameters of being prudent bankers. We needed $2 million. The bank furnished, I think, about 1.7, less than that. Oregon Business Development furnished $500,000. And then we also borrowed an additional $200,000, $100,000 from the City of Drain, and $100,000 from Economic Development of Douglas County. Those two loans, that $200,000 has been repaid, so we've reduced our debt there. And the important part, I think, from my perspective, is we were an employment base for the city of Drane and for Swiss Home. We represented about 40% of the employment base for Drane and about 80% for the community of Swiss Home. So it would have been absolutely devastating to those communities if we had liquidated the company. It wouldn't have affected the owners particularly a lot, but of course all the employees in that particular community would have affected them greatly. And we're quite enamored with the department or whatever it is, that they were able to do that for us. And would like to represent them as being very good at what they did. Representative Smith, you asked about liquidation of the company and the risk. The owners of the company are personally guaranteed on these loans and would insist on taking the lead on liquidating any of the properties to protect themselves. We do large projects. We did the Autzen Stadium job. We did the glue laminated beams for that. The beams get so big they have to have little steering rigs out underneath the back of the beams. I'm sure Senator Morris is familiar with those. And we've specialized in areas that other companies have drifted away from. We do highly customized work. We do the arches. We do large curved work for churches. And we did the Eugene Airport job. We also did the stadium at Corvallis, did the expansion that they did there. And we feel we're an important asset to the community, and we're sure glad we're still here.
My name is Jeff Workel. I'm the founder and president of a distribution added value lumber company called Hardwood Industries. I'm a native Oregonian and resident of Newburgh there. I've never met you, Senator George, but we share the same town in a way. But just briefly about our company, started it as a one-person entity in 1981 and have grown it to about $21 million in sales and currently 63 employees, and that number goes up and down as the economy changes. But I've had been fortunate to have used the services of the Oregon Business Development Fund twice. I think we had loan number 20, which was about $144,000 for a building that we currently occupy. And that facility would have not happened had it not been for that loan and subordination position that the state of Oregon takes. It was about a $750,000 project at the time in 1986. Recently, in 1998, we started on a project. We're currently in three different facilities in Tualatin. We also have branches in Bend and Medford, and also one in Seattle, Washington. But started in 1998 to try to consolidate our facilities and improve our efficiencies. And different times. This is a pretty good indication of what a small business goes through in trying to get funding. In 1998, I went to our financing bank, at this time still is West Coast, Bank of the West, pardon me, and you come up with 20% and we'll do 80. And the 20% was going to be a 10% equity for myself and 10% from the SBA. Well, 99 came around price of money started going up, and the business environment in Oregon started to drop, and so the bank came back to me and said, how about 75-25? And so I began thinking, well, that's a little tougher, but I can still use the SBA. I can go up to $1 million with the SBA. The project's a $6 million project, and I can make the numbers. And then 2000 rolled around, and the ratio changed again. And so how about 65-35? And so I went to my bag of tricks and called my friend Gary Ross at the state of Oregon here, and he said, yeah, we'd be interested, because I had, in fact, paid off a loan. Loan number 20 was no longer a loan. It had been paid off and refinanced. And we began working with the state of Oregon again. And as late as September 2002, on the same project, my bank came to me and said, hey, how about 50-50? And so I said, you don't want to be my bank, do you?
Exactly.
And so I contacted West Coast Bank and worked with their loan officers and the SBA and Oregon Business Development Fund, and put together a 65-35 equity package, and hopefully we'll close on the property and construction loan in a few days and make this project happen. So it's certainly a challenge to run a business, and the big issue is cash. You know, how do you fund your business? How do you fund your growth? And you know, the easiest way is to earn it, and it's been tough in these markets to earn it. You can borrow it, which the state of Oregon has helped me with now twice. And the last way is return on investment from the standpoint of real estate, which is a huge factor in our future growth that we think will occur because of this building. It's been a pretty good number, but every $1 million represents about three jobs for us. And so at $21,000,063, we're right on right now on that number. And we think that by consolidating this over the next few years, we'll approach $30 million in sales, which would be a growth of 30 jobs. And, you know, that's maybe generous, but our history has proven that to be a truism. You know, I really don't have a whole lot more to say than that, but I am very appreciative of the financing and support. And you know, I feel like, you know, from the guarantee side, I feel like if I failed, you guys would have my kids, you know. So they make sure that they're covered pretty well on that.
Question, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said value added. What do you actually do or produce?
Well, we originally started with just distributing hardwood-related lumber, plywood, and sheet stock in the marketplace. And what's happened over time is it's become more and more competitive, and the ability to make a profit on that has been very difficult. And so the distribution people, and you'll see it in many industries, are now beginning to add value, where they will take the product and maybe they would mold it, make a molding, you know, base molding, case molding, or semi-finished dimension on the product, and we have moved in that direction. And most of the companies that we're competing against are moving in that direction as well, and it's creating some manufacturing-type jobs, but it's the inventory that we have. It gives us the ability to make the sale happen. It's a combination of profit of both. But most of the, it's difficult to make a huge profit on straight value-added services only. You have to have the added value of the profit in the product to make it go.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be a question to both you, Jeff, and Pete. And it's not a fair question, okay? It's a hypothetical one. If the state offered you a participating credit, would that have been of any interest to you? In other words,
I think under the circumstances, yes. We were in a position that we would have looked at anything favorably.
Well, anything that helps your cash position in a business, you know, it's just the number of businesses out there, you know, on their survival edge are, it's, we deal with mostly 2 and 3 man small shops. And these people are working very, very hard to survive. And, you know, a big service we offer is offering credit, open accounts. And if we didn't do that, you know, we wouldn't survive at all. And same thing happens for us. Anything you can do to increase our cash position is a tremendous benefit. I just tell you a quick side note here. On one of our accounts, a little guy walks in one day and he hands me a card. And I go, Doug, what's this? He goes, I started a new business. And the name is weird. And it's Leviscerous. I go, Doug, what does that mean? He says, well, spell it backwards. It's survival. And that's the state of most small businesses today. It's about surviving today. It's not about making a big profit. You got to survive through this. That's just
Senator Morris and Mr. Chairman, philosophically, I'm against the government being in business with private enterprise. But sometimes when you're over a barrel, you do what you got to do.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, I'm not suggesting that the government be in a leveraged position. But it seems to me that this whole enterprise is really focused on creating jobs, and how do you turn the dollars to create more jobs and make it more effective? I raised that question not with a lot of forethought, but just out of curiosity.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things interesting about our particular business is probably 80% of our product goes into California, and probably less than 5% do we sell within the state of Oregon. So that means 95% of our income is coming in from out of state. That's out of state money that's coming in here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martini did have some handouts too, so of his project. So if the committee would like to have those for further review, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, these are case studies that were done by the American Plywood Association of some of the work that we've done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, at the beginning of this morning, I chatted a little bit on page 34 of how those five fingers, if you will, represent what we're trying to do on the business finance side of things, as well as the small business. That kind of concludes our discussions of those particular areas, unless there is any questions that anybody would have that I'd be happy to try to answer too. Just an observation is that I am sensitive, and I do pick up very strongly that accountability side of things. In the past, people have suggested how difficult it is to identify the sustained jobs as well as the created jobs. And my own past experience has been I've been surprised of how many people have taken credit for the growth of my own companies at any one particular time. And so I'm very sensitive to that. It is a hard number to drill down to, and we're going to continue to try to drill down to that number, but I do want to acknowledge and understand that that is a number that we'll try to get as best as we can.
Director, I haven't seen the numbers in here. Just maybe I missed them. And that is the tax consequences of the survival. I mean, first of all, if you have anyone's in business, you know, you have one person who's now employed who may have not been employed or they've been underemployed or whatever. But the incentive of a surviving business is to grow, either grow or die. And so that is going to eventually result in, you know, job creation. And so I can see that if we take, for example, Senator Carter and I have talked about over the years, a private individual who was making loans to particularly minority women businesses was an amazing success story. I don't know if you've seen that. I think it was on 60 Minutes or something like that. They had several reports on that. It was amazing survival rates of people who, you and I would have said, oh, they have no chance to make it in business, but yet they did. And, of course, you know the long-term consequences of taxes being paid, other people being employed, and that sort of thing. So is there any way to analyze what kind of tax receipts we've earned from this?
Sherry seems to have some information here, and I'll pass the microphone over to her.
Good morning. Sherry Shun with the department. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you go to your overview, page 25, we anticipated that you may be interested in knowing the tax consequences to the state in the form of income tax as a result of the work we do. Setting aside the jobs being only our best projection at this point, as opposed to what we know actually have occurred, because we are talking about projection for the 0305 biennium. Mm-hmm. Assuming we're successful with those number of jobs, Director Brandley and others have briefed you over the last week or so, we calculated as a result of the business development programs, which you'll remember has a request for $16.3 million in lottery investment, primarily in the form of strategic reserve fund deal making money and investment in the small business program that you heard about this morning. The 17,850 jobs, we assume, for the sake of this calculation, that the department will claim credit for only 50% of the jobs that are projected to have resulted because we touched these jobs. However, for the sake of calculation, we also assume these jobs are going to be available for the entire duration of the 24-month period, because we don't know at this point whether these jobs will come evenly on a quarterly basis or not. And we then apply the average wage of the jobs the department had our hand in, either in creating or retaining over the last 5 years, in order to come up with an average wage. We did not do an inflation adjustment of that average wage. We just used the old figures. That gave us, using the standard formula that we calculated, a total payroll, number of jobs, average wage. From the total payroll, we estimated 4.4% income tax contribution to the state. And by agreement by most of the economists, that is a conservative figure. Using the 4.4% income tax average rate, we ended up with a $39 million income tax revenue contribution to the state as a result of these jobs that the department had projected that we would have our hand touching. You'll note that we did the same thing with our community assistance part of the proposal, which primarily is making funds available to the regional rural investment program that decisions are made at the local level, not by the department. And their projection is 1,900 jobs. Using the same methodology, we ended up with a $4.4 million income tax revenue contribution. By the way, these tax revenue contributions are projected on an annual basis. The lottery fund request is made for the biennial basis, which is shown in our current budget proposal.
Very good. Is there anything further to bring before the committee? Senator Morris.
Begs the question. How do we do more of this?
Well, I think that this has been an interesting exercise for me over the last, as I say, 94 days now. And it has been one of getting everybody to focus on what we need to do. And as I said, going back to those parameters of, has everybody got the vision? Do we have the structure? Do we have the people? And do we have the money? Over the last few days and over the next few days, you will also have the opportunity to kind of chat with the people and get up to speed more so on some of the programs and how we're trying to refocus those programs. Jobs has been consistently mentioned, whether they be retained or sustained or grown. And part of the reason is my fault, quite frankly, is just because I'm trying to ask for a return on investment. What are we getting for this? And that is an imprecise tool. We're going to continue to try to sharpen that tool. It'll always be somewhat imprecise, but we're going to continue to drive to that goal, too. I think that the budget that we're submitting tries to be respectful of the very difficult time that you all are going through. In certain places, as you know, we're about $13 million underneath the governor's requested budget. So again, and the revised budget, I believe, we're about $5 million. I forget exactly the figure, $5 million underneath the governor's suggested budget on the revised basis. So, again, we're trying to say we understand the very difficult thing you're going, but I think that we all truly, truly believe that we are part of the solution. And the money that you all might agree to and pass on for the infrastructure allows us to do the infrastructure side of things, to create the industrial parks. And then the money that we've been talking about in the last few days allows us specifically to go after the companies. We can't do that with the infrastructure fund. So that's what we're aiming for, and we just ask the chance to prove that we can get the job done for you.
Senator Morris?
Does the department have balance sheets, income statements?
I don't know that we do. Sure, you want to touch on?
Sherry Shen with the department. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the department as a whole has our budget, and our budget as a whole does not go through an audited statement, if that's what you're thinking about. However, as you know, most of the department's financial resources are in the various revolving loan funds, And many of those do go through audited statements. Actually, I had gathered the most recent audited statements issued by the Secretary of State's office of our large revolving loan funds, a couple of the programs, and had planned to bring them over for you, but I did not want to overwhelm you with volumes of paper. But suffice to say, the business finance programs that you heard about today also issue financial statements. We take those funds very seriously, and obviously it's very important for us to know the current balance sheet, the size of the portfolio, the performance of the portfolio, the projected needs of these funds over time, in order for us to manage that cash flow in a way to really effectively revolve that loan. And you are going to hear about infrastructure programs tomorrow. And at that time, I would like to bring the financial statements here so you have a chance to see how we manage various aspects of our financial asset.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we were presented a balance sheet income statement from the Lottery Commission, which was a bit of a shock. I didn't know that government subdivided their activities in statements, and so that's what caused me to ask the question. And it seems to me that the activity of the OECDD is discreet enough that it would justify carrying its own balance sheet.
It's an interesting thought, and we'll look into that one to see if an overall balance sheet too. Again, 77%, as you know, of our budget is really in that infrastructure side of things, but nevertheless, it's something to kind of look at too.
Sherry Shen, sorry, I should say that as part of our budget development exercise every 2 years, we do go through the financial audit by DAS, Budget and Management, and as we go through that exercise, we certainly have extra pairs of eyes to make sure that what we show in our books match with what their expectations and records are, and in addition to the individual fund being audited by the Secretary of State's office.
Director, I'm just going to share something with you, and this is my opinion, and you can deal with whatever you want to, but I think it springboards off of what Senator Morris was saying. We had some business folks who came in the full Ways and Means Committee a few weeks ago and said basically that smart businesses invest in the downturn, so they're ready to pick it up when it hits the top. And Senator Morris and I are looking at this from the standpoint of business people, and the rest of our colleagues have to come up from the same point of view, and that is, let me give you an example. State Parks State Fair comes in, and of course, you know, here's the problem. A lot of general fund dollars and a need for general fund. But at the same time, we made a substantial investment in that state fair operation out there. And one of the things they were needing was a person to go out and make the sales necessary to make the revenue to balance all these numbers. And of course, we've been able to go ahead then and advocate for some things. And it's going to be up to the co-chairs, the governor's office, what finally happens here. But one thing I would like to hear from your office is if there's anything we know that you can do to get this economy going, and I know you're moving on the right areas of regulation, streamlining, and all these sort of things. I want to hear about those things, and I think the rest of the committee does too, from the standpoint that as big as this thing is and as big as the problem is, there's still ways that you can do things that actually end up with you yielding additional revenue for the state. And so don't hesitate to bring us ideas, because we will be able to go out and advocate for those if we, you know, buy in and believe them. So I know you've done a nice job of trimming things down, and the co-chairs, you know, took a little whack at it and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I want to know, what do you really think about where we're headed, and what should we be doing if you had, you know, you had everything you needed to do it? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably more philosophical, and don't go and do a lot of research that is unnecessary to answer this. But thinking, looking at some of the information that was provided here, we're third in the nation on percentages of small businesses, that we seem to be a pretty positive place for small businesses. Thinking Nike, Starbucks, Microsoft, at one point were small businesses. And I'm wondering if there's any correlation in terms of if we're creating a lot of small businesses in our economy, if there's a spin-off effect, that those are actually incubators of the very large major businesses 15 or 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there if anybody has ever done any correlation like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, as you might know, I'm trying to kind of be in touch with a lot of the different businesses around the state, and that's one of my goals over this next year, as you know, is to contact at least the 100 businesses. And it's surprising that in my conversations with at least in the last couple of weeks, people have said, look, we're okay, we're struggling, but we're okay, but who you really need to get to is the companies that are 25 to 50 employees right now and want to be us in the next few years. And so I've asked for lists of those names because I think that those are underneath the radar screen sometimes, and those are people that we have to go after a little bit more aggressively. And so that is something that we're going to do. Don't have a name of that. We've just started at that on the manufacturing side, quite frankly, more than anything else. But that is an excellent comment and observation.
Very good. We thank you again.
Senator George, thank you. I always used to refer to what your thoughts were as a blue sky budget. If you could do that, you know, give me a blue sky budget, and I look forward to putting that together, too. Thank you.
All right. One is blue sky, you have lots of green.
That's right.
With that, we will close the public hearing and invite a testimony on House Bill 5013. At the gavel will be adjourned.